Welcome to Voices,
a podcast from the Institute for Human Rights and Business.
Here, we're seeking to elevate the range of perspectives
on the role of business in the world
and in people's everyday lives.
My name is Annabelle Short, and I'm here with Susan Kaplan talking about equity in the built environment, the places where we live and work, which have so much influence over the lives we lead. Buildings contribute almost 40% of the world's carbon emissions. Reducing these emissions, both from the construction process and when buildings are in use, is a fundamental part of our fight against climate change. Susan has worked for many years within the green building movement in the US to ensure that as buildings go green, this is done in a way that also benefits the people who use them and who live nearby. In other words, making sure that inequality and equity are taken into account. Welcome, Susan. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Annabelle. Happy to be here.
I've heard you say that an important step is for architects to expand the definition of their clients to include all of those who are affected by your building, often the people with the least say. And I'd love to start off just by hearing a little bit about what that means to you and why it's important.
I think we all tend to be very internal when we're looking at our buildings and our building design. You know, clearly there's a lot of issues within, but buildings have such an impact on the community. Even, you know, starting with aesthetically, walking past a building and thinking, oh, why did they put that there? Or, wow, that is so beautiful. I'm so happy to walk by that every day. And then into how it affects the community at large. Was a building that was loved replaced by this? Did it cause gentrification? People were displaced? Did it disrupt easy walk to a local park? And how does it affect the people who are building it, who are maintaining it, who are coming in and out of the building all the time? And can it actually make the community better? Isn't that a, you know, wonderful result if you can do a building that people in the neighborhood love and feel like you've created a sense of community there, that you've added to their quality of life?
And am I right, you have some examples when you felt that that's really been put into practice?
I was at Green Build Sustainability Conference 2 weeks ago, and there was a really great project called the Lotus House Shelter in Miami. And it was done by a not-for-profit called the Sundari Foundation. And their tagline is, where hope blossoms. And it's a shelter for women and children. It took 5 years to get it through all of the approvals with the city and the community, but it has been such an incredible success. And it looks like they've just really thought of so many aspects of how a building affects people's lives. So they have staff that includes social workers. They're really trying to break the cycle of homelessness. The rooms all have roommates so that people aren't alone and have some immediate community around them. They looked at design. It's, of course, 100% ADA compliant, but they also look at inclusivity. They look at classes. They have yoga and dance space. They have arts lab. They looked at the physical aspects. They have curved walls. They had high ceilings, new furniture. They had a really big community engagement process, and they have a community health clinic for the surrounding community. They have a child care center that you can use even after you've left this facility. And they have an annual block party for the community. They have a lot of staff that used to be in this facility, and they have programs to help people get places to live. So it really, and it was beautiful. It was really inspiring that something could take all of these important aspects of people's lives into consideration besides just the physical and the immediate needs.
That sounds like a wonderful project. And for architects who are embarking on, I guess, any project in the built environment, what do you see as some of the factors for a project like that or any others that they're working on to really make sure that the needs of both the users of the building and the neighboring community are taken into account? What are the factors that make that happen? And then maybe that stand in the way of that happening as well?
I think the most important thing is always engaging with the community. And I know it's not easy and it's messy. I had an architect tell me once that he really cared about these issues, but he just felt so awkward being in these communities where he's not at all like the people in the community. And it was sad because I know this is a person who really cared about these issues. And I think there's different ways of doing it, you know, whether you find different community groups that already exist and you partner with them, or you come with a completely open mind. Like in my neighborhood, they were putting in a new housing development and they came with completed renderings. And so you can imagine the response. They say they want to hear what the community has to say, but looks like your design's already done. They had a grocery store, and this site had been, or it still is now, a 35,000 square foot grocery store. So for New York City, that's huge and it's wonderful. And it serves a lot of different communities in Brooklyn. And somebody asked from the audience, well, how big is the new grocery store? And he said, well, 7,000 square feet. You know, you can't do much in 7,000 square feet.
It sounds like you're pointing to what's often a very big disconnect, yeah, between the people who are doing the designing and then the people who are impacted by those designs and the need to bridge those gaps.
Yeah. And in the end, the developer had to go back and redesign because there was such outrage by the community. There were like 400 people in the audience and a lot of public officials because they had heard wind of this. And this was about 3 years ago, and the grocery store is still there. So they clearly haven't got through all of their approvals yet. And I just think, in all seriousness, that if they had just started with the community and said, this building is for sale, we're going to buy it, how can we make this a building that helps you?
Absolutely. I know you've been very involved with the US Green Building Council, where you've helped to develop both some pilot social equity credits and a social equity checklist. And I would love to hear a little bit about why you felt there was the need for those. How did those first come about? And then also, what type of factors have you included in them?
The pilot credits started when we created the social equity working group. So probably about 8 years ago now. And the first thing we did was kind of try to define, you know, what is social equity and what, as a building professional, can we hope to incorporate into a project? And we talked to a lot of people in the field because most of us had such little experience. And we came up with accessibility, community, human health, jobs, and quality of life. And from there, we tried to create a credit that had metrics that one could measure. So you could say, yes, you have achieved these. We brought it to the staff and they said, well, this is great, but I think this is 3 credits. And of course we said, yes, please. So we broke it down into project teams. So what the architects, the developer, the political officials, and the contractors could do to make it a more equitable project. So we talked about living wage. We talked about training for construction staff. We talked about getting a B Corp certification, which looks at the governance of an organization. And we also gave credit for organizations that were willing to go through the corporate sustainable reporting process, just because it requires you to look at things like diversity, gender, the pay between them, the highest paid and the lowest paid, pro bono work. And the idea being, if you go through that process, you have to at least address where you are. And hopefully good things will come out of that. So that was one credit. A second credit was about community engagement, that you go to the community early on and continuously throughout the process and really try to understand what the community needs and wants, what their aspirations are, and how you could fit in to that. So making it a loved project rather than just one that they have to put up with. And the third one was on the supply chain, how you select products for the project that address human rights issues, that are not using child labor, that are using organizations and manufacturing firms that are allowing, if not unionization, at least ability for people to get together. That one has been the hardest. I think that manufacturers are not quite on board with that one yet, and we've just revamped it to make it a little more approachable for manufacturers. And I think of it like the way that first stages of LEED said that your materials, to get a credit, use materials that are within a 500 mile radius. And at first, architects said, well, we don't know that. And manufacturers don't know that. They don't know where their subs are. They don't know where every piece of steel is for their structure. And little by little, it became a normal process. And so I think the idea of the supply chain will happen like that. Well,
step-by-step process and overcoming major challenges, I imagine, in terms of complex supply chains and transparency of information about what products are coming from where.
Yeah, that's right.
So within those three areas, and you mentioned in the project team, the angle of gender, diversity more broadly, and also gender, I'd love to briefly touch on that. As a woman working in this profession and within the built environment, do you feel that the built environment sectors generally continue to be male dominated? And how has being a woman in this space influenced your approach to it? What it means to you? Do you see a need for continuing to increase the number of women who are working in the built environment professions?
Certainly. You know, architectural schools now have, I think, a fairly equal percentage of women versus men. I think it's kind of broadened to be a little more accepting of everybody. And I feel like this new generations have started and will continue to push for all kinds of diversity, whether it's sexual preference or gender or all of the other issues of religion and even socioeconomic levels.
Yep.
So I think it's actually gotten a lot better in terms of male, female, and I feel like it's starting to open up. You know, in some ways, I feel like I've had some discrimination. I worked on a construction site for a while in my early days. And, you know, in some ways, the contractors didn't know what to do with me. So they were kind of polite and a little more open than I was worried they would be. Which is not to say that's good, but I think it's changed a lot since then. There's a lot more women in construction. And I think there's even more ability to make way for that, even things like restrooms.
Exactly, accommodating for the needs of women workers on site and potentially creating job site targets, yeah?
Yeah.
Just on the credits, going back to that, I would love to hear what the reaction's been. Is there a demand for this? Are developers and architects interested in using these credits? What's the response been? And what do you see as the chances for really scaling this up so that eventually this just becomes part of doing business?
Yeah. The credits are pilot credits, which are in a whole different category for LEED. The way pilot credits began is USGBC was looking for a way to add new ideas. And it's a long process to develop another version of a rating system. So what can you do in between to start getting ideas into LEED and trying them out? So that's how pilot credits started. That being said, I think people still aren't as aware of them as could be. And so they're not as well used as we had hoped. At the Greenbelt Conference, the head of USGBC just announced a USGBC equity initiatives. And that was very exciting. We've been working with him, Mahesh, I never get his last name, Mahesh. How do you get it into governance? How do you get it into how the members look at things? And how do you get it into all of the LEED systems? The LEED for cities is another one of the rating systems, and that now has a lot on quality of life and something we call demographic analysis as a requirement, where you actually have to look at the community around the building so you can start to understand what the needs are. Are there very few parks around here? Are there very few grocery stores that have fresh food? And looking at it at a census tract level so you can really see, not only does the city have maybe a very high education level, but what is it in the census tract? And is there anything you can incorporate into your building to look at that? You had mentioned before this checklist. And I think that's a really good tool as well. We started that after I gave a presentation at an architectural office of all the different kind of systems that are out there besides LEED and what they're all looking at. And at the end, one of the architects said, wow, you know, I wish there was just a checklist. There's so much here to look at. And so I thought, so let's do a checklist that just at least gets people thinking about issues of equity. So they include things like, have you identified who the stakeholders are beyond just the building owners and political officials? How have you engaged with them? What about your social media? Are you sure that you have a way of different people who don't usually get to have a say? Are your renderings looking like the people around the building, looking at human rights issues and how you pick your materials for the building? So it's meant to be just a very open-ended, eye-opening exercise. And last year at Greenbelt, we used it with a real project in Chicago, and we got the community members there, and then we got public officials, and it was really great to bring it through that. And the political official said, wow, this is really great. I could use this as a way to look at the developers that are answering an RFP. And the community group said, this would be a great way to talk to the developers. Have you looked at this? What are your thoughts on that before a building gets built? So I think it's a way of going beyond the rating system. I think, you know, we shouldn't just depend on people going through LEED, that every project should have a way of starting to think about these issues.
Absolutely. And speaking of that then, so if you were to project, let's say 10 years ahead from now, what gives you cause for hope in terms of scaling up this way? And you can start, if you like, with some of the obstacles. You know, is it time, finance, people keep those blinkered approaches on and don't take these things into it?
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah, how do you see those big obstacles? But then also, what's giving you cause for hope if you look towards the future?
You know, it's a messy process. And that is a huge barrier. And I feel like developers and architects and planners, public officials are nervous about getting too much input and what they might have to do. And they see it as a negative. But I think if they really started to understand the risks of not looking at a project from different perspectives, that they will see it makes so much more sense to engage at the beginning.
And it sounds like you'll say an engagement right from the outset. Identifying what those risks might be and mitigating them. Yeah.
And I think social media has made it a lot easier. And there's a man named Dr. Antuia Kam in California, and he's created this whole platform where anybody can get on and put information on a map. Like maybe it says there's a grocery store there, and somebody will write, that's not a grocery store, that's a liquor store that has old bananas and stale white bread. So it, you know, it's starting to be able to get real information out there to anybody who is interested. I also think the risks are going to start pushing it, that investors start looking. They don't want to hear that there's human rights abuses at all connected with the building, that someone died in construction because they didn't have clear enough safety requirements on the project. There was a project in Massachusetts where there was a Living Building Challenge building, it looks like a beautiful building, and there was a Black Lives Matter protest at the opening of the building. So, you know, I think people are very aware of what's going on and willing to push back a little bit. And I
just on that protest, was that connected to the pushing up the prices of housing nearby, about not having consulted the local community? Like, sort of, what were the dynamics that were being brought up in that protest, if you remember?
That one was Hampshire College.
Okay.
And it was about the students. It was a student building, and the students just didn't feel like they were being considered. Also, I was in a commercial interior fairly recently, and it was for a group that does software, so completely unrelated to sustainability. And on the walls, they had the UN Sustainable Development Goals and images about them throughout the office. And I thought that was quite wonderful, you know, just building awareness of issues of poverty and housing and water, so that it raises everyone's consciousness a little bit and maybe helps them look at things a little differently and look at equity issues a little more.
Wonderful. Yep. Broadening people's minds and the contexts in which they're working.
Yeah.
Just as it sounds like you do through your work. So thank you very much for taking the time today.
Oh, my pleasure, Annabelle.